Who is Cole Kublik?
No idea.
This could be troubled.
Now with the call, Cole Kublik.
Auburn.
We just talked to Cole Kublik a little while ago.
You watch him now on the screen.
It's bad ball. It's bad football.
That was Jim Bellett, number 61.
I get.
Speak up, please.
Get you some of that, Jalen Tabor.
Is that good enough for you?
I'm almost embarrassed.
You can be miserable, but they are going to be miserable with you.
I said what I said.
We have to score.
What an exciting time in America.
And here he is, having the time of his life.
Don't clap. That could be tough. Don't clap.
Welcome back in, Cube Show, Sports Radio 730 and 103.9 The Yump. Some huge news dropped this morning from Pat Forte and Pete Thamel. Photographs of federal documents detailing the potential NCAA violations in this FBI probe into college players, coaches, AAU coaches, agents, etc. We talked about would some names begin to drop from this case before the NCAA tournament, before it all went down, before maybe even conference tournaments, and now they have. Players from former, current players from schools like LSU, Maryland, Kentucky, Washington, North Carolina State, North Carolina, Texas, Notre Dame, USC, Utah, South Carolina, Vanderbilt, Clemson, all named in some of these documents that were dropped in a story this morning on Yahoo Sports, thanks to Pat Forte and Pete Thamel. Bank records, expense reports, and more released by Yahoo Sports. From former NBA agent Andy Miller, his associate, Kristen Dawkins, who, based on what you see from some of these documents, looks as though he acted as Andy Miller's runner. Balance sheets, bank statements, cash advances, entertainment and travel expenses for high school and college prospects and their families. Now, this is only two guys, so one part of the case, and many, many individuals that are implicated in this FBI probe. But you got guys like Bam Adebayo at Kentucky, Isaiah Whitehead at Seton Hall, Dennis Smith at North Carolina State, Markelle Fultz at Washington, Bradley Van Fleet at Wichita State, P.J. Dozier at South Carolina, current Texas player Eric Davis, current USC player Chimezie Metu, current USC player Benny Boatwright. Then there's a list of players who apparently met with this agency. Current Alabama player Colin Sexton, current Duke player Wendell Carter, current Kentucky player Kevin Knox. So some high-profile guys. Some looks like there could be some big trouble in their future. Others, or I guess in their school's future. Most of these guys are going to be gone soon. I don't know if the NCAA can get in there fast enough to hold them out. But I guess the real question is, Arky, with some of this information being released and now being seen, what are the schools going to do? Are the schools going to play high risk?
Well, it depends on, obviously, who we are and what the infractions were discussed. And when we discuss Colin Sexton, the issue doesn't seem to be, at this point, money being received by family or by Colin Sexton, but by the meeting of Colin Sexton and or family with this agent. And Alabama's response can be very simple. This is all we found. This is all we know. And we sat him out for the Memphis game to start the season. And you guys said that's okay. So we are good to go. We are clean. We are clear. And we are ready to resume our SEC play and tournament and hopefully the NCAA right after that. But it is more interesting when you talk about guys who have not been punished so far. Because we talk about Daniel Purifoy and Austin Wiley, who are out for Auburn. They're not mentioned in this specifically, but they are being held out. It was presumptively because of the FBI probe into further into things. And like you said, this is just the tip of the iceberg. The higher risk is an interesting sort of way to put this. There are not a lot of current players that are listed right now. There are just a couple.
And that's just, but that's just on these documents.
Correct. Correct. The vast majority of these over 25 players are guys who were former and like really recently former, like Markelle Fultz, for example. That Utah guy, Uzuma, who is having a good season so far in the NBA. Dennis Smith Jr. These seem to be guys who are gone, and there's not much you can do to them. It's about what you can do with the university and what to even do with the university. So this round seems to be fairly calm as far as the current players are concerned, but it does sort of show just the beginning steps and the depth of this, where this goes, because this goes from all the way from, you know, powers like Kentucky and Michigan State down to teams like Creighton, who are all mentioned in this particular set of documents as far as having, quote, loans and cash gifts. And that's just exactly what we were being led to believe, which is this has a chance to be the widest, deepest, and maybe darkest NCAA scandal as far as the entirety, the totality, the breadth of it, how far it can reach. Because you're talking about, just here, some kind of punishment for 25-plus players in more so likely universities. And or 20 universities. And that is that's a big number just to start with. The NCAA was asked for a statement late last night, right before the story is being finished and put up early this morning by Pete Thamel and Pat Forty. And they did not have a statement. You know why? Because there are so many tentacles to this. What do you even say if you're the NCAA? Other than we're looking into it, which no one really cares.
No, I think
anyway.
That's all you can say right now. It's just there's going to be so much to this. And when you look at potential, I guess when you look at sort of the potential violation of schools, what did we just talk about earlier this week about, you know, do you go back and vacate wins, or do you punish schools currently for things that happened in the past? If that's the case, there's already multiple schools who would be implicated and potentially not eligible for the postseason this year if this is found to be legitimate.
Yeah.
Now, that's the other part of this that I think you have to be a little bit fair with is, like I always say, prove it.
Yeah. Well, this helps. This helped, especially with three current players. And you're talking about Wendell Carter, too, is a really good player for Duke. So there's three high-profile names that are current players that are among this list of documents. And so that is what could possibly be at stake for this year's NCAA tournament as far as current players and their eligibility. But it seems to be Colin Sexton has his thing figured out, and they'd already taken care of that at the very beginning of the season. Because they went through that investigation at Alabama quick to find out what he or his family, and I think the story was that his family ended up having a meeting with this agent, and he set out for the Veterans Classic to start the year. I don't think Kevin Knox has been suspended or held out of any games because of this. And I'm not sure about Wendell Carter, but I don't think Kevin Knox has for Kentucky.
No.
So, is there still things to be able to come? Kevin Knox are really important. Those three players were mentioning really important players for their team.
And keep in mind, these are just the documents from one, I guess, agency, one group of people who are implicated in this entire FBI investigation. You still have Tony Bland at USC, Chuck Person at Auburn, Emmanuel Richardson in Arizona, Lamont Evans of Oklahoma State. You have the SHU executives, James Gatto, Merle Code, Munish Shute is a financial advisor. Rashawn Michael, the clothing guy over in Atlanta that was apparently tied to a lot of these. There's AAU coaches that are still being investigated. So you mentioned the tentacles. They are plentiful in this potential case, and more information that's going to potentially come out. But this is a big part of this entire investigation that we discussed, in that how many names would come out, would names come out before the tournament, what would we learn, what would we begin to know, and this is pretty big. And I have to think that with this information being released, whoever Pat and Pete at Yahoo have, because let's be honest, they're probably not taking pictures of this. They're being sent pictures of this. So whoever is feeding them information, it's only going to keep coming. They're only going to be able to get more of it. I would seriously doubt that they were able to obtain this type of documentation from one aspect of this case and not be able to get any more of it, unless their information is from the attorneys of Andy Miller and his guys. And because they obviously wouldn't be representing the other coaches, players,
right,
AAU guys who are implicated in this. That'd be the only way that I don't see any more information coming out in the near future, to be honest. That's what I would think.
Yeah, so,
I don't think this is...
It's a very fluid situation, too. It's a very fluid one, which is, you know, this isn't the end of it. This is the beginning of it. I mean, I happen to think that we're probably in the still... maybe close to half of this, as far as being over. We finally are starting to get some information. We were asking yesterday, I was saying that I didn't think they were going to give us any information for the tournament. Well, we got some names now.
Yeah.
We got some names. Almost all of them are former players. But there are a couple of current ones. So
it'll come down to...
It's worth paying attention to.
It'll come down with these cash payments. Was the school involved? And can it be proved that the schools were involved?
I mean, there are legitimate balance sheets being kept up because, you know, expense reports, and some of these guys are wanting to get recouped,
sure,
their money for paying some of these flat out cash, some paying for meals, things like that. There are balance sheets with names specifically written out. Bam. They found out it's Bam Adebayo. Adebayo. Brandon Haywood. Carlos DeFino. Chaz Williams. Dennis Smith. He's got a couple of loans for, I think, $73,000.
Yeah, he had one loan for $43,500.
And he didn't sign.
That's probably the biggest mind-boggling aspect of this whole thing for me is that, I mean, Bam Adebayo, over $43,000 in loans, and they don't sign him?
Yeah, 43.
You're bad at your job.
Kyle Kuzma, $9,500. Kyle Lowry on here for $5,927.51. He wants every nickel back. Clearly, you want every nickel back. We're like, this is what I paid. Malik Pope is mentioned on this. Nerlens Noel is mentioned.
Jarrell Martin, $52,472.72.
I honestly, God, don't know who that is. I mean, we could do a quick Google search, probably find it, but off the top of my head, I have no idea who that is. But it's funny because some of these, like Carlos Delfino's, like has like a loan here for like
$71. $71.39.
Sorry, it's not like it's $75,000 going for everybody, but you know that's probably more of a meal paid for to meet with the agent or his family as opposed to go buy yourself something nice.
Yeah, so it's a pretty big deal. All right, let's. Let's get to 10 After Tweets, brought to you by First Family Mortgage. Go to 1FMC.com.
Bring me the tweets!
Andrea Alderson coming up at 7:20. Pretty cool story that she's got out on ESPN.com right now, documenting a high school coach inside that Florida shooting that shielded students and lost his life. It's pretty powerful. We'll talk to her in 6 minutes. Fox News tweets, breaking news, Missouri Governor Eric Greitens reportedly indicted on invasion of privacy charge. Have you seen any of the details from this?
No, yesterday afternoon I saw a report that he was being let out by like St. Louis sheriffs or something. That's the only thing I saw.
He had an extramarital affair with a woman, and he has admitted to that, but he is not admitting to anything else that's involved with this case. It is alleged that the 43-year-old in his home took the woman downstairs, And in a taped interview, the woman claims that the governor of Missouri asked her to come downstairs so he can show her how to, quote, do a proper pull-up. The woman alleges he taped her hands, blindfolded her, and took partially nude photos of her and warned her to stay quiet about the sexual encounter. Quote, you're never going to mention my name, otherwise there will be pictures everywhere.
Wow. There's some weird dudes out there.
A statement from Greitens yesterday said, quote, as I have said before, I made a personal mistake before I was governor. I did not commit a crime. With today's disappointing and misguided political decision, my confidence in our prosecution system is shaken but not broken.
True, cheating on your wife is not a crime. It's against the Ten Commandments. It's against God and everybody. It's not technically a crime. But if any of the other stuff is true, there's a bunch of crimes in there.
Yeah, former Navy SEAL has a Bronze Star and Purple Heart. So, disappointed to see that news, though.
Also got a black eye on his criminal record now. Hey, I found out who Jarrell Martin is. He is a first-round draft pick, late first-round out of 2015, plays for the Grizzlies. Played 31 minutes last week against the Thunder. There you go. Had 8 rebounds.
Okay.
17 points. Not bad. Making $1.5 million.
SB Nation tweets, Conor McGregor is back. The notorious MMA posted on his Instagram, I am fighting again, period. I am the best at this. I put my name forward to step in at UFC 222 to face Frankie Edgar when Max Holloway pulled out, but I was told there weren't enough time to generate the money that the UFC would need. I was asked, excited about bouncing in last minute and taking the final featherweight without all the rest of the stuff that comes with this game. Please respect the insane amount of work outside the fight game that I have put in. On top of the fighting, I am here. It is on them to come and get me because I am here. Yours sincerely, the champ champ. Trademark.
That can't be trademark, really? I guess it could be because it's so stupid. The champ champ. I'm the rhino. That's what I mean. So does that mean he is going to fight or not? Like is that him saying, I was going
to
fight?
He's here to fight again, is what he just said.
But there's not enough time. There wasn't enough time for the last fight.
Yeah, this sounds kind of like a attention grab excuse to me of, hey, I told him I would do it. But they said they can't come up with enough cash before I'm actually able to do it. So
that's on them.
Sure. They bought it for like $4 billion. I'm sure they could come up with a couple million somewhere to give to you. All right, Andrea Alderson and her story on Aaron Feist, an assistant high school coach that was gunned down at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida last week. She joins us next to discuss. Back in Cube Show, Sports Radio 730 and 103.9 The Yump. Andrea Alderson of ESPN joining us now. You can follow her on Twitter at @AaldersonESPN. A really cool story that she has published at ESPN.com. We'll tweet the link out to that shortly, and you can go catch it if you'd like. Andrea, good morning. How you doing?
Good morning. I'm good. How are you guys?
We're doing great. The story of this assistant high school coach, Aaron Feist, has gained a lot of momentum and traction very quickly after the tragic shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida last week. I think a lot of folks kind of saw very quickly that he was someone that had acted in a heroic fashion, and the next day we found out he lost his life. Just take us through how you began to formulate this story that you've posted on him at ESPN.com.
Well, obviously, everybody was talking about how he died a hero the next morning, Thursday morning. And there were so many ties related to sports, not just with his story, but with so many others who tragically lost their lives. We decided it was important to tell their stories. And the thing that struck me in reading about what happened that day was there were college recruiters sitting in the football coach's office when the shooting happened. And I thought to myself, gosh, I bet there are a lot of college recruiters out there who know Aaron Feist. And it shows, at least to me, the interconnectedness of high school coaches with college coaches and with college recruiters. And that was my initial thought, was talking about how everybody in this world is completely connected. And I wanted to initially reach out to college recruiters to get their thoughts on him. And that eventually led me to some of his very best friends who filled me in on the way that he helped players get recruited. And I'm not just talking about players at his high school at Douglas. He helped players across his home county, Broward County, get recruited, players from other schools that were in the inner city or in suburbs. Any player who needed help, he was willing to help connections for them with recruiters that he had gotten to know. And so many of the people that I ended up talking to told me he didn't have to take a bullet to be a hero. He was a hero every day because he worked in this community to make sure his students had the best possible opportunity for success.
Visiting with Andrea Alderson now of ESPN, discussing her story of assistant football coach Aaron Feist, who lost his life in the school shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. When you began discussing what happened that day with some of the people that knew him and that were around him, how did they describe his actions and their thoughts of his actions that eventually cost him his life?
Every single person I talked to, and I talked to 8 people for the story, and this was all over the phone, trying to get people on the phone to talk to me about him, every single person said they were not surprised, that he was the type of guy who would do anything to help his school, help his students. This showed the type of person he was, the type of heart he had, the type of character he had. When someone told me, I heard it was an assistant football coach, the first person who came to my mind was Aaron Feist. They were not surprised that he would do something like this in order to try and help save the students at that school.
Andrea, when you discussed with folks exactly what went down that day, I mean, how detailed were the actions, his actions, that you were able to gain information on from what he did and how he did it?
Well, that, I think, is still the one unreported part of the story, because nobody has been able to find the student that he saved or the students that he saved. This is a school, I believe, that had 3,000 students, and a lot of these students are still so devastated by what happened that a lot of them aren't talking. So I think that's going to be fascinating as these students get back into school, as we continue to report. This was just the first story about him. There are plans for us to continue reporting out the story and writing, because we just feel it is so important to tell his story. But it's my understanding that he was on his golf cart. He worked security at the school, and he raced immediately toward the sound of the shooting. He was in communication over the walkie-talkie with the school officials, and somebody came over the walkie-talkie when they heard the initial sounds of gunfire and said, are those firecrackers? What is that sound? And Aaron Feist reportedly said, those aren't firecrackers. And that's the last time anybody heard his voice over the walkie-talkie. Everybody believes that he went on his cart racing toward where he heard the sound of the gunfire and was eventually able to save students. And unfortunately, he lost his life.
Andrea Alderson of ESPN joining us now, discussing her story at ESPN.com of Aaron Feist, assistant football coach at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School, lost his life in that school shooting, tragic event that took place over a week ago. You mentioned that he was on his golf cart and he did serve as a security guard at the school. What was his background with the school? Did he begin at the school as a security guard and then sort of work his way into being an assistant coach?
He played center at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School. He graduated in 1999, and eventually he came back to work as a football coach and work security. The football coach he played for is named Elliot Bonner, and they were extremely close. That was his mentor, and he came back and decided that he wanted to make a difference and an impact on his community, and he felt the way to do that was to go back to his school and work with the students at the school. So he worked security, and he was a longtime assistant coach. He coached the junior varsity teams at one point, and then he served as recruiting coordinator. That's why he has all of these connections to all of the college recruiters across the country, not just on the FBS level, but FCS Division II, Division III, NAIA. He is so well connected. That's how he was able to get so many opportunities for a lot of these players to get to school. Somebody estimated that he was able to get 50 to 70 players signed in the colleges because of the work that he did, and those players may have slipped through the cracks otherwise. So he wanted to be a football coach. He never really desired to be a head coach. He just wanted to be at his school. It was his dream to work at the school and to help the people in his community.
You think about that area, and I know one school that will sort of ring true with a lot of folks in this area is Dillard High School. It's noted that he's helped some players from that school receive college scholarships. And Dillard, longtime ties to Auburn University. Some teammates of mine that I played with, Charles Dorsey, and people know James Bostic and Frank Sanders, long ties from Dillard High School to the SEC. So it's like you said, it's not just his school, but there are boatloads of talent within a very short distance of where he actually coached.
Yeah, there's no question about that. And you mentioned Dillard. One of the people that I talked to for the story that really struck a chord with me, obviously everybody did, and I had to bite my lip to not cry as I was talking to these people as they were spilling their hearts out over what a hero Aaron Feist was in their community even before this day happened. I got a phone call late Tuesday night from Wednesday night. All my days are running together. But it was earlier this week, and he said, "Hi, my name is Wayne Lyons, and I want to talk to you about Coach Feist." This was completely out of the blue. I didn't know who he was, never reached out to him. And I said, "Please tell me about Coach Feist." And he says, "I went to Dillard High School, and I was under the radar, and Coach Feist volunteered to make a highlight tape for me." This was before the era of Huddle, when you had to have somebody make these tapes for you to put onto YouTube. I didn't have anybody to make my highlight tape for me. He did it on his own dime, on his own time, uploaded it up to YouTube, and eventually this got him noticed. He ended up going to Stanford, transferring to Michigan. He has degrees from both of those universities, and now he's working as a mentor to children in the Ann Arbor area. And I said to him, "So let me get this straight. You're a kid growing up in the inner city in Fort Lauderdale. You really don't know how people are going to notice you. Somebody from a different high school who didn't even coach you steps in to make your highlight tape, and now you've got 2 degrees from some of the most prestigious academic institutions in our country?" And he said, "Yes." And Aaron Feist did that for me because he made the highlight tape. I mean, imagine that. And think about all these other people out there who have stories just like that. That, to me, speaks to who Aaron Feist was every single day.
Andrew, it's a really powerful story. It's a really cool story to see, especially just in the midst of what actually took place and 17 students and faculty members losing their life there in Florida. But it's really cool to see someone be able to act this way that had done so much for so many young people before this tragedy took place. So hopefully we can continue to remember him for a long time. But glad you were able to share the story, and we appreciate you sharing how you put it together with us.
Thank you so much, and really thanks for giving me the opportunity to talk about him. He truly was a special person, and if there's anything anyone can take away from his story, I hope it's that one of the most important things in life is to make an impact in this world, and that's what he did.
Thank you, Andrea. Look forward to catching up soon.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Andrea Alderson of ESPN. You can follow her on Twitter, at @AaldersonESPN. Just, you know, you don't hear many stories like this that come out of, you know, we hear about, obviously, we're going to begin to talk about things like gun control and school safety and what can we do, but to just know that someone acted this way and showed this type of a heroic effort, it's one thing that I know we always and hope that we would do if we were put in this situation one day.
It's a powerful story that she has written. It's a powerful story to tell. And especially when we now know the backdrop of what was given to us news yesterday, that the man who's in charge of security at the school didn't even go in toward the gunfire. He stayed outside the school. And that you have this football coach who basically got in his car to go as fast as he possibly could toward the gunfire to try to save kids. I mean, it's just, it takes a special kind of human being to do something like that.
You know, it's one of those things that you hear that part of the story that you mentioned, you almost don't want to bring that up, and you don't want to place a lot of emphasis on that and talk about that. But the Associated Press did report yesterday that the sheriff's department there in Broward County, that the deputy on duty at the school where 17 people lost their lives, never went inside to engage the shooter and has now resigned. That is unfortunate. And there is one part of that that I don't think a lot of people read that, hear that, discuss that they will ever really consider. And that's that man's going to have to live with that for the rest of his life.
Absolutely.
And that can't be something that you gain a lot of peace with on a daily basis. So
no. But it does sort of juxtapose the specialness of Coach Feist.
Absolutely.
That he, who's not trained in any of this,
no,
who's not an armed officer, who's not, you know, been, you know, taught these things, puts his own safety off to the side to go try to save kids.
You hope that, like Andrea said, the actual students haven't really come forth to discuss this in detail yet, but I hope that one day they're able to, because I hope that more positive can come out of his story, just to show that there are people that are out there still willing to sacrifice. There are people out there that care about the greater good. There are people out there that want to do what's right for today's youth, and they go above and beyond what they're asked to do in their daily lives. So appreciate Andrea joining us. Really cool stuff. We've linked the story at Cube Show's Twitter account. If you want to go see that there, you can do it when we come back. Gabe DeArmond's going to talk Michael Porter Jr. and the future of Missouri basketball next. Welcome back in Cube Show, Sports Radio 730 and 103.9 The Ump. You can listen online at umpsports.com. Download the app in your app store, iPhone or Android. Search WUMP, and you can hear us there. Gabe DeArmond is going to talk some Missouri basketball with us now, joining us on the phones as we are live in the Madison RV studios. Gabe, good morning, man. How you doing?
Not bad. What's going on, Cole?
Not much. Were you surprised to hear this news about Michael Porter Jr. yesterday, that he has been clear to participate in basketball activities? I know some people hear that and probably think, he's going to play this weekend.
Right.
Probably not necessarily the case, but how surprised were you to hear that he will be now able to participate in some activities, and what do you expect for the near future?
Yeah, well, let's say, first of all, like you said, it doesn't mean he's going to play this weekend. I don't think yesterday necessarily means he's going to play this season. We'll see. I think that's still possible, but I think people are jumping to conclusions thinking that's definitely going to happen. But I wasn't surprised. I mean, Mike told us 2 weeks ago, you know, the next doctor's appointment was to get cleared for contact and be ready to go. It's right along the timeline. The timeline they originally told us was 3 to 4 months. Yesterday was 13 weeks since the surgery, so that's right about 3 months. You know, so now the question is really, how good a shape is he in? How quickly can he integrate to this team? And how soon, if he's ready to play and if he's willing to play, is Konzo Martin willing to put him on the floor?
Let's talk a little bit about that. Do you think, because of Missouri and the way that they have sort of heated up the last month or so, do you think that sort of adds more of an emphasis that he may actually try and come back and play this year, as opposed to just completely sitting it out and getting ready for the draft?
I mean, I think it does, because, you know, if Mike looks at this team right now, I think most people think they're like a 7 or an 8 seed. Obviously, 3 games left in the regular season in the SEC tournament, that could go up or down a little bit. I think most people think they're in the tournament, barring, you know, a collapse. They lose 3 or 4 straight, they'll fall out, but if they can pick up a win or two, they're going to get in. So if he looks at it, obviously the kid is very confident in his abilities for good reason. If, let's say, Missouri's an 8 seed without him, he probably looks at it and says, okay, I play. We're a lot better than an 8 seed. And the one thing that, if Mike does come back, what I cannot wait to see is the reaction of the 1 or 2 seed that would theoretically draw Missouri in the second round, because – somebody's going to be pitching a fit. Hang on, I just drew a team that was a 7 seed without the preseason All-American. It just added. Somebody on the committee must hate me.
We're visiting with Gabe DeArmond. Follow him on Twitter, at Gabe DeArmond. Find his work at PowerMizzou.com. This was a team, like Arky mentioned, Gabe, that sort of seemed to be heading in the right direction. And they've got Kentucky again this weekend, this time on the road. They were successful against Kentucky the last time they faced them at home. But then all of a sudden you look up and drop two straight at LSU and then Ole Miss. Not two of the better teams in the league, and especially with Ole Miss right after Andy Kennedy departs. How do you explain the last two outings for these Mizzou Tigers?
Well, the one at LSU is a loss you can live with. I mean, the team had won 5 straight, was probably feeling pretty good about itself. Road games, I think that was the day where every home team in the SEC won. LSU's beaten some teams at home. So, and really, Missouri was a good free throw shooting team that went 7 of 17 from the line that day. Like, sometimes things happen. That loss to me was not that bad. The Ole Miss loss was horrible. I mean, that cannot happen. If they just win that game, there's no question they're in the tournament. But because they lost that game to a team that had lost 7 straight games by 15 points, there's no way you can lose that game. And I think what happened in that one was Missouri just kind of thought, hey, we'll put our Missouri jerseys on and we'll roll the ball out and we'll beat them because, you know, they don't really care. Had Missouri jumped out early, Ole Miss might have quit. But by the time Missouri decided it needed to play, Ole Miss believed it could win that game. And then in the last 2 minutes, Missouri did what it's done all season, which is do almost every single thing wrong at the end of a game. They've managed to win some of those games, but even some of their wins, Stephen F. Austin, Mississippi State, Texas A&M, like those are games that they had big leads and easily could have and probably should have lost in the last couple minutes. I think really the last two have more been evidence that if you play with fire over and over and over, eventually you're going to get burned. Missouri got lucky a few times, but they got unlucky the last two.
Gabe DeArmond joining us of PowerMizzou.com. When you talk about this Missouri team outside of those previous two losses and you look ahead at Kentucky, at Vanderbilt, Arkansas at home, a tough stretch there, but how much work do you think this team still needs to do to assure themselves a spot in the NCAA tournament?
I think if they win two more, they're in without worrying. And, you know, we throw the term lock around this time of year. To me, a lock means you go to your conference tournament. It doesn't matter what you do. You're going to feel comfortable on Selection Sunday that your name's being called. I think if Missouri wins at Vandy and beats Arkansas at home, they'll be in that position. Now, they probably would want to go ahead and not lose a game to a 12 seed in the opening round in St. Louis. But I think this game against Kentucky, to me, is just all upside. I mean, if you go lose at Rupp Arena, so what? Everybody picks that as a loss before the season anyway. And I understand this is not vintage Kentucky, and now obviously they'll probably have a few other things on their mind today with Kevin Knox's name popping up in the story this morning. But, you know, if you lose that game, it's okay. But this season really comes down to me, you got to go to Nashville and beat Vanderbilt, which is not a good team but has won 5 in a row at home over some pretty good teams. And then you've got to come home and you've got to beat Arkansas at home in the regular season finale. And there are a few fan bases in America who are more familiar with what Mike Anderson does, which is dominates people at home and largely can't beat anybody any good on the road.
Yeah, Gabe, everybody hates Memorial Gym. That's not Vanderbilt. That's just a fact.
I've never been. I'm covering that game on Tuesday. I've never covered a game there. I'm really interested to see what it's like.
Yeah, I don't know why Vanderbilt, even in their bad years, seems to be able to beat teams like Alabama, TCU earlier this year when they were in the Big 12 Challenge. TCU was a really good team at the time. Anyway, I wanted to ask you, if Michael Porter Jr. is able to come back and play, and let's say, you know, gets into shape, does whatever he needs to do, what kind of timetable are we looking at him coming back? Like maybe last weekend of the season, SEC tournament?
That's the million-dollar question. I mean, I'll be honest, guys. I'm not going to rule out that he could play a few minutes on Saturday. Now, I don't think he will. That doesn't really seem like Konzo Martin to me. What I have been told, because this Can Michael Come Back storyline has been going on for about a month. I mean, this isn't a new development in Colombia, and I was kind of told all along he needs a week of practice. Now, I think people don't really understand a week of practice during the college basketball season. Like, it's not like they practice every day. They practice for like an hour and 15 minutes, probably maybe three times a week, you know, because they're playing games and traveling and watching film and all that. So I'm not saying that means 7 days of practice. I'd be surprised if he played on Saturday, but I'm not going to rule it out. I would think you could maybe get him some minutes at Vandy and then some more minutes against Arkansas and then go into the SEC tournament with whatever his ceiling is, whether that's, you know, 20 minutes a game, 30 minutes a game, whatever it is. I would think you want to go to St. Louis and start to approach that ceiling. Now, you know, the thing I think Missouri fans also have to kind of understand is if you get Michael back, you're not getting the guy you thought you were going to get last March. I mean, you're not getting a kid who's a legitimate threat to score 30 every time he steps on the floor, I don't think. Now, maybe he's Superman and would come in and prove me wrong, but I think it's more likely what you're getting is a guy that definitely makes your team better, but not a guy that maybe you go into every single game you play and say, we know we have the best player on the floor, because it's going to take Michael a little bit to be the player he was.
Mizzou fans are going to lose their mind if he takes off his warm-up Saturday, I'm just telling you.
Oh, it's going to be insane. I mean, I think Saturday would be, if he's even in uniform, you know, they're going to lose their minds. It would be really cool for it to be at a home game. Because, look, there are a ton of people, and people are enjoying this team and all that, but there are a ton of people who bought tickets to watch this kid play, and they haven't been able to. So if he does play at home March 3rd against Arkansas, that's going to be something else.
Gabe, I did want to ask you quickly. I saw Ben Fredrickson tweet yesterday. Derek Dooley is killing it at the Mizzou football recruiting caravan stop in St. Louis,
yeah.
Pacing with the microphone, has the room rolling. If he calls plays as well as he rocks the mic, he'll be eating crow for criticizing the hire. I'll be eating crow. What in the world do we expect from Derek Dooley as the Missouri offensive coordinator?
Yeah, nobody knows. I mean, what you've done is hire a guy who's never been an offensive coordinator and never been a quarterback's coach to run what was last year a top 10 offense with one of the top returning quarterbacks in the country. Now, they did promote Austin Carter Samuels to an offensive analyst, and he's going to be working with the quarterbacks a lot this year. But, you know, and I don't know, Cole, maybe you disagree with this. I've always been one that believes, you know, play calling is overrated. Like, play calling is just what people criticize when a play doesn't work. But I would think that Drew Locke, Demarie Crockett, Larry Roundtree, Albert Okwuegbunam, and an offensive line returning intact could make somebody look like a pretty good offensive coordinator. I mean, I think what we'll know is if Missouri's not good on offense this year, we'll know Derek Dooley can't do this job. but I think we'll find out more if he can after Locke leaves.
So all good points, Gabe. Great stuff. Thanks for the time, man. We'll catch up soon.
All right, sounds good, guys. Thanks.
Follow Gabe DeArmond on Twitter, at Gabe DeArmond. Find his work at powermizzou.com.
Still really interested to see what Derek Dooley's going to do for offense.
No idea what to expect, but Gabe's right. Mizzou's got guys coming back on offense, man. It's not just Drew Locke. I mean, they've got running backs, they've got tight ends, they've got offensive linemen, they got a couple of receivers. They have a chance to be the most dynamic offense in the SEC by far. By far. Now they're going to need to get some stops on defense. They got to figure that out at some point in time, but also what's it going to look like? And I agree with them. The play calling aspect sometimes does get overrated, but scheme and system matters, and how you prepare for an opponent and how you try to find matchups, that definitely matters. Back with more Cube Show. Archie Redraft next.